The takeoff point for Marx is very definitely Hegel, because Marx took this dialectic that we've just been talking about and interpreted it in materialistic terms instead of idealistic terms. For Marx, it was the interplay of material factors, and more specifically, the interplay of the means of production in society that would bring about the ultimate goal. And naturally, the ultimate goal for Marx is a materialistic goal, not an idealistic goal. Instead of having a goal of freedom, we have a goal of a classless society. Marx's system is much more extensively developed than Hegel's, and it is a truly monolithic system. That is, it's like a pyramid. It's like a massive pyramid in which each element interlocks with each other element. And we're going to put this on the board here in the form of a pyramid in order to make it possible to see just what's going on. This, believe it or not, is a pyramid. With levels. At the bottom of the pyramid, we have the fundamental principles on which the system is based, and each subsequent element is grounded in the elements below it. It's monolithic. This means, of course, that if there is something the matter with the bottom layer, this puts everything above the bottom layer in jeopardy. It means that if there are any problems with the elements below a given element, that element is likewise in trouble. But it also means that all aspects of the system interlock so that we have a system which can be talked about in that fashion, as a system. It is not just a kind of pasting together of ideas that have no intimate relationship. At the bottom of this pyramid, as the root principle of Marxism, is a materialistic metaphysic. That is, a materialistic world view. We have been nasty in using the term metaphysic for this, because if there's anything that a Marxist does not like, it's the idea of metaphysics. Says the Marxist, we're not talking about philosophies, we're talking about concrete facts. But of course, that's a philosophy, isn't it? That you should talk about concrete facts and not talk about other things. Thus, fundamental to Marxism is the worldview or the philosophy that things are all basically materialistic, or if they're not all materialistic, the important ones are material, and they are the ones that give rise to the rest. There are different forms of materialism. There is a kind of a strong materialism and a mild materialism. The strong materialist says everything in the universe is material in character. The mild materialist says some things are material and some things aren't, but the material things are the important things, and they give rise to the rest. It's not particularly significant to determine whether Marx himself was strong or weak. Marx did his PhD dissertation on Democritus, who is perhaps the greatest Greek expression of materialism. My good friend Paul Dibon of the Sorbonne, who is here in the philosophy department this term, and I had a very interesting discussion a couple weeks ago, and Dibon maintains, and I think he's absolutely right, that Marxism at root is a pre-Socratic philosophy, and that even the golden age of Greek philosophy saw the absurdity of a monolithically materialistic view of the world. In other words, it would have done Marx a great deal of good to have read the classical Greek philosophers and not simply the pre-Socratics. Plato had a good deal to say on this subject that is of continuing worth in dealing with the question of materialism. But in any case, at the root of the Marxist system is a materialistic worldview or metaphysic. Then, founded on this, is the dialectic. The dialectic. And this is, of course, Hegel's dialectic, and we probably ought, we won't put Hegel's because that might give the idea that this is idealistic, but it's the dialectic that we've just been talking about. In other words, you start with material things, and those material things interplay dialectically. The next stage of the pyramid is the economic interpretation of history. This is a further refinement of the first two levels. It isn't just any old material factors that are primarily informative for history. It is particularly the economic elements. It is by the interplay of the economic that historical events come about. Then we have the theory of surplus value. This is a further refinement of the economic interpretation of history, and it's quite complex. We can't go into it here particularly, but in essence, it amounts to this, that society is divided into those who control the means of production and those who do not. Those who control the means of production grind down on the ones who don't have the means of production in their hands. Or putting it in popular terms, the capitalist grinds down on the proletarian, and in the course of doing this, he reduces the member of the proletariat to the worst possible state. This is in an effort to gain maximum return. In other words, to build capital. But ironically, in doing this, those who own the means of production, the capitalists, destroy themselves as well as destroying the workers, because the workers are really their greatest resource. Thus, the capitalist machine is like Hieronymus Bosch's hay wagon. It's being led by demons into the abyss. The whole business is eventually going to come to an explosion. It can't be otherwise. This brings us to the next level of the pyramid, which is class war. Class war. How does this come about? Well, the day finally comes when the proletarian realizes, in the words of Marx and Engels' Communist Manifesto, that he has nothing to lose but his chains. In other words, things have gotten so bad that it really doesn't make any difference what happens at this point. He might as well defend his own interests. If he doesn't do so, the result will be the loss of everything. He has even reached the point where it isn't possible for him to consider his own life of value, because his own life will be ground out anyway by this system. Thus, the proletarian rises up against the capitalist overlord. There is class war, and in this situation, the proletarian inevitably wins. Why? Because the capitalist is continually trying to hold on to vested interests and onto a status quo that's falling apart anyway. He does have something to lose, or thinks he does, whereas the proletarian, in fact, has nothing to lose, and therefore the proletarian gives himself totally to the struggle, and the result is that he wins. And this results in a temporary state, and we better make this a dotted line, a temporary state known as the dictatorship of the proletariat. During this temporary state, the proletariat gets rid of the last vestiges of capitalism. This is a mop-up period, and it's necessary for the proletariat to deal with this in a dictatorial fashion. You can't have democracy in a thing like this, because democracy might mean that the capitalists would be able to reinstate the system which is so despicable. So during this period of time, the proletariat simply excises this cancer from the society. And the end result of this is, of course, the classless society. This is a society in which the means of production society are divided among everybody, and thus there is no longer a conflict of classes. This is the goal for society, and it really ought to be put in a kind of, to use the expression of St. John of the Cross, a kind of cloud of unknowing, because this is the mystical goal of the whole business. Marx felt that history would proceed through four epochs in reaching this goal, and these he took in part from Hegel: the Asiatic, the ancient, and by ancient he meant Greco-Roman, the feudal, and then finally the bourgeois capitalist phase. And the bourgeois capitalist phase is the one that we've especially described here, of course, and that will issue out into the goal of the classless society, even as the Germanic phase issued out into the goal of freedom for Hegel. Now you notice that this is a goal-oriented view again. It's definitely a goal-oriented view. History moves on toward a definite goal, exactly the same sort of thing that Hegel has in mind. Just a little parenthesis that might be of interest to you. Why is it that these writers use a fourfold conceptualization of history? Why is it that they talk about four world historical epochs? Well, it's been shown that Hegel got this from the four empires in the Book of Daniel. And Marx got it from Hegel. This is just a cute little indicator of the point that I was making earlier, namely that these people are living off of inherited capital. And that's an intended pun. They are living off of the inherited capital of the biblical view of history. But you know, inherited capital has a funny way of running out. You can live on Papa's money just so long. If the grounding of the view happens to be a grounding which you cannot maintain yourself, then this results in a basic insecurity in the position which will show itself finally. With Hegel, it showed itself as soon as the Germanic Empire found itself in a little less advantageous position. In the case of Marx's system, this has likewise revealed itself as having numerous problems, but it has now become a religious position in the strict sense of the word. It is indoctrinated to vast numbers of people in the world today, and thus there are many people who accept this not because they have really thought it through, but because they have found themselves in a position where this is the only cement that holds their society together. What are the problems with this? Well, we'll very briefly run through some of them. In the first place, it's impossible to demonstrate a materialistic view of history, any more than it's possible to demonstrate the fundamental concept of the dialectic. How can you show that material factors always are fundamental to all other factors? Now, you can certainly show that everything in normal experience has a connection with the material. For example, had Bach not eaten, he would certainly not have been able to compose the B minor mass. But you cannot conclude from this that by stuffing Bach, the B minor mass results. There have been many obese people in the history of the world who have certainly not produced B minor masses or anything roughly resembling them. The Aga Khan had no tendencies along this line whatever, as far as we can determine. In other words, it isn't enough to show that there is a material connection in life. Anybody will admit that. What you have to show in order to support this is that in every case, the causal lines go most appropriately from the material to something else. Now, I'm willing to admit that in certain cases, the causal lines do go most appropriately from the material. For example, it's easy to show that the wealth that poured into Italy in the years preceding the Italian Renaissance, when the balance of trade shifted in the Mediterranean between the Moslems and the Italians, this influx of wealth had a great deal to do with the Renaissance that occurred in Italy. You can show connections like this. But it does not follow that you can explain the Renaissance in Italy on the basis of wealth pouring in. Wealth has been pouring in to that jolly state in the Near East as a result of the oil discoveries. Kuwait. Why, they've got more money than they know what to do with, but there are no indications of Renaissance there at all, really. the attractiveness of the girls in the harems does not necessarily mean that there are going to be great artistic productions depicting them or anything of that kind. The presence of material factors, then, does not in itself explain most readily all historical phenomena. We've already talked about the dialectic, that the dialectic cannot be demonstrated as a necessary principle. You can see it operating sometimes, or you can see a dialectic kind of phenomenon. Sometimes, however, it goes up, and sometimes it goes down. It certainly doesn't seem to be a factor that can be used for explaining the whole of history. How about the economic interpretation of history and the theory of surplus value? Those of you who are married or who are contemplating marriage recognize that economic problems, the budget, comprise a very fruitful source of marital argument. It's been shown that a very large number of arguments that take place in marriage take place over the budget. But it does not follow that once budgetary problems disappear, there are no more marital arguments. This is simply a way of illustrating that human activity is far more complex than Marx realized. And indeed, Marx's conception of human nature is one of the weakest aspects of his entire system. Sure, economic factors have a great deal to do with what goes on in history, but they are not the only factors. Human beings have a way of creating a tremendous amount of fuss over a lot of things besides the economic. Human beings are very well able to create a mess over economic considerations, but this is not the only manifestation of the human being's ability to make a mess of things. And the idea that the control of the means of production in society will inevitably bring about class war is a view that Marx could take in the middle of the 19th century in the wake of 1848, the year of revolutions, but it's not very easy to take this viewpoint today. Why? Well, because there have been other ways of dealing with the same problems. For example, Marx did not conceive of the proletariat organizing to prevent the capitalists from grinding down. The labor unions, as we have them today, represent an organization of proletariat such that it becomes very difficult for capitalism to make life miserable for the proletariat. In fact, sometimes it reverses. Now the labor unions make things so miserable for the capitalist, for the owner of the means of production, that he wishes he could become a member of the labor union. And government has entered into this. Antitrust legislation and the like has made it difficult for untrammeled capitalism to rule an economy. And in certain instances, the interference of government or the operation of government in this situation has produced a situation where both the capitalist and the proletarian are scared out of their wits as a result of increasing power. And all of this illustrates a very fundamental point about human nature. It's the point made by Lord Acton, the editor of the first Cambridge Modern History. Said Acton, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Marx thought that power corrupts only in the hands of capitalists. But the fact is that power corrupts in the hands of anybody. Sure, capitalists will grind down on proletarians, but the proletariat will grind down on the capitalist, given the chance. And the government will grind down on both of them, given the chance. Human beings are grinders down. This is not limited to one aspect of life. It is characteristic of all of life. Marx had an exceedingly naive view of human nature. He thought, like the inventors of the early cowboy movies, that you could easily identify those who wear the black hats. But the fact of the matter is that everybody, in varying degrees, wears white hats and black hats. And so the problem of the difficulties in modern life is a far more complex problem than the isolation of the means of production in society. Class war, then, is not a necessary result of a class system. There are certainly tendencies toward class war, just as there are tendencies toward marital argument in any marriage. But it does not follow that every marriage has to break up, nor does it follow that every society has to collapse as a result of a class system. Moreover, it's interesting to consider an argument by a Yugoslavian who has roundly criticized Marx. This is Milovan Delos, the author of a work entitled The New Class. His name is sometimes spelled D-J, sometimes D-I-L-A-S, Milovan. He has spent a good number of years in and out of Tito's jails because Tito is not wild about his literary productions. He generally gets out after a book has died down in its effect, and then he spends his time in jail writing a new one, or spends his time outside writing a new one, which puts him back in. But the point of Delos' new class is that when a Marxist system gets into the saddle, it does not eliminate the class system. All it does is to create a new class system where the bureaucrats within the Marxist system grind down on everybody else. In other words, this dictatorship of the proletariat does not winnow away, as Marx said it would. The state does not disappear. The fact of the matter is that once the proletariat gets in the saddle, or the so-called representatives of the proletariat, namely the bureaucrats of the revolution, the result is that they hang on to power for dear life, so that the state shows no signs of winnowing away in countries where this system has come into existence. In fact, there is a tendency for such a dictatorship to harden, for the categories to become even harder. There were some well-meaning liberals who felt that everything was getting peachy keen in Russia. And then lo and behold, along came Czechoslovakia, which simply indicated that the bureaucrats in Moscow were no more willing to allow any deviation to take place within the Eastern Bloc than anything in the world. And then finally, we come to this classless society at the top. And I put this in a cloud for good reason. This is as millennial a conception as you can possibly get. The only difficulty is that it doesn't have any metaphysical basis for it. Marx felt that once you remove the tensions in society, then the result would be that people would have no difficulties with each other. The capitalist lion would lie down with a proletarian lamb, and there would simply be no difficulties. As we've said, human nature and its present condition is far too complex for this sort of thing. You can imagine the situation after the revolution. Think of Rostov and Slabovich there in a cafe in Red Square just after the revolution. It's something like the last scene in George Orwell's 1984, but everything is peaceful, things have worked out fine, it is a utopia and not a cacotopia, they are sitting there, and it's very peaceful, tranquil, birds are flying over, robin redbreasts to fit the symbolic pattern of the regime. Everything is idyllic. And finally, Slavovich says, "It is too damned quiet around here." In other words, he has gotten used to a style of life, and the very tranquility bothers him. And people are like this. Merely to have the problems of economics dealt with is not going to mean that everybody is going to be tranquil and happy and have no difficulties. There's a story told about these same two gentlemen. This is just before the revolution, and one of them says to the other, "Ah, comes the revolution. We eat peaches and cream." And the other says, "But I don't like peaches and cream." "Comes the revolution, you eat peaches and cream." See? Which is exactly the monolithic kind of mindset involved here. That the perfect society is going to come about, you see? And human nature is forced into this kind of Procrustean bed, whether it likes it or not. This system can't be maintained any more successfully than the Hegelian system. There is no necessitarian character about it. It really is a secularization of the biblical view of history. If you know more about the biblical view of history than this, you'll see even closer parallels. For example, history moves along to a final battle, to an Armageddon. That's the class war. And following the Armageddon, there is the Messiah's reign and the millennium. As a matter of fact, Marx grew up in a nominally Christian situation which had Jewish roots. Marx was of Jewish background, but his parents had converted to the state church, not apparently with any great religious convictions involved, and Marx had had contact with just enough of the biblical philosophy of history to make it dangerous. And what you have here is a secularization of the thing. All right, we're going to conclude at this point, and we are going to open up the session to questions for the last 15, 20 minutes. Yes?
Two questions on Hegel. Would you comment on the Dr. Schaefer's premise that his dialectic has caused us some problems today in eliminating the thesis antithesis, and also that you kind of hinted at it, that is his view, but I understand he had a rather cavalier attitude toward the facts of history where they didn't agree with his view of the way of it transpired.
Yes, the question is, how does this interpretation relate to Francis Schaefer's view of Hegel, that the dialectic has posed some problems for us, and isn't it an important consideration that Hegel worked in a rather fast and loose fashion with the facts of history in doing this operation? Francis Schaefer recognizes that dialectic thinking has entered in to the mindset of many people since Hegel, including professing Christians, without their often realizing that this is the case. This is certainly true, and a dialectic has a way of softening a person's cranium so that it becomes very difficult to do clear thinking about anything. Why? Because you are not allowed, in the strict Hegelian logic, in quotes, to isolate factors and to consider them in themselves. You can't take anything in itself. You've got to take it always in relation to its contrary. Thus, no element can be analyzed as such. Hegel said, in fact, that the only way to know the truth is to see all of the factors as they develop in the dialectic process, so that you understand the particular only in terms of the maximally general. Now, to that, Bertrand Russell says, that's all very well, but if that were really the case, we wouldn't know anything. Because we don't know the whole, spelled W-H-O-L-E. We simply don't comprehend the totality of the universe. And if it were necessary to know it in its totality, in its full dialectic development, before you could understand any particular, where would we be? And in Bertrand Russell's analysis of Hegel, there is this line, which I think is marvelous. It's the concluding line of Bertrand Russell's discussion of Hegel. It says, Bertrand Russell, all of which indicates that the worse your logic, the more interesting the results to which it gives rise. The Hegelian system is wonderfully interesting, and it's interesting because it is bamboozled logically at the very outset. The fact is that Hegel has to be able to distinguish between a thesis and an antithesis at the very beginning, or he couldn't even talk about a dialectic blending of them, you see? So that he presupposes what is the only logic. The only logic happens to be the logic which derives from the law of non-contradiction. Whitehead and Russell showed this in the Principia Mathematica, and don't let anybody tell you that there are peculiar Indian logics. You'll often have people say to you, ah, you would understand my religious position if you understood my Eastern logic. Well, studies of non-Western logics have shown that though the symbolization is different, the symbolism is different, the concept is exactly the same. You cannot operate apart from the law of non-contradiction. And people who think that they're working dialectically in theology, for example, I've been dealing with this a little bit in my other class, people who think that they're operating dialectically, theologically, get their brains scrambled to the point where they cannot distinguish one thing from another. Now, as to the other aspect of this question, Hegel's handling of historical facts, it is a kind of standing joke in philosophy of history that Hegel was so little concerned with historical facts. The fact of the matter is that he was dead convinced of the dialectic, and things had to work that way, and so in his philosophy of history you have a selection of facts that nicely illustrate his point. There is, in fact, a Geschichtliche story about Hegel, which is sort of like Washington crossing the Delaware about Washington, that reveals a good deal of Hegel's character. This story attaches, I think I mentioned this in another class period, the story attaches to Kant also and sort of hangs over the whole of Germanic philosophical and theological scholarship. And it goes like this. A student raises his hand and says, in the middle of one of Hegel's lectures on the philosophy of history, "But Professor Hegel, the facts do not agree with your system." And Hegel is supposed to have said, "Then the facts be hanged," and continued his lecture. This has a lot more truth in it than you would imagine. Hegel operates really in a fast and loose fashion with the facts. They are whacked into the dialectic Procrustean bed, and heaven help them once they get in there. Okay, another question. Yes?
I think you said that the Greeks did not consider or presuppose any external influence on their view of history.
Excuse me, I didn't quite say that, but go ahead.
At least a non-creator type of view. I just wondered how their view of
Yes. Yeah. The question is, what about the Greek polytheism, the conception of the gods on Olympus, the Homeric and Hesiodic conception of the gods? How does this fit into the Greek view of history? Well, for one thing, in the golden age of Greek philosophy, the pantheon of gods, as presented in Hesiod and Homer, was pretty well discounted. In fact, Plato would not even allow such works to be read in his ideal state, because he felt that this sort of thing corrupted the youth, that this was obviously an anthropocentrism. The gods were simply human beings with all their failings writ large, and therefore this did not enter into the philosophizing of the Golden Age. There was, however, a conception of God in the Platonic philosophy, for example, and this is instructive, it's worth mentioning. God was known as the Demiurge, which means the intermediate level worker, and the business operated this way. Plato presented this in mythical terms, that one day the Demiurge woke up and he found himself in a kind of cosmic woodshed with the materials for the creation of the universe already there, and with a set of plans. And these plans represent the ideas or ideals, which for Plato were ultimate, see? Now the Demiurge set to work, and he created the world as we presently have it out of this stuff, following the plans. The reason that the world is in such a mess is not that the ideals are off, and not that the Demiurge was a poor craftsman, but the stuff that he had to work with was not very hot. It was a poor lumberyard, all in all, and he did the best that he could, but this brought about the world that we presently have. Now you see that in this conception, the creation is from pre-existent stuff, and Plato is not solving the ultimate question as to where that stuff came from. For him, the ideas exist in the universe from the outset. And you can see, therefore, how this ties with a cyclical kind of view of history. It certainly is not the kind of linear ex nihilo creation view that we've been talking about here. Yes?
You mentioned that Hegel brought his idea of the four divisions of history from Daniel, where
got a footnote on that in The Shape of the Past. Check in the index under Hegel, get to the section on Hegel, and wander about in those footnotes, and you'll see a reference to it, and you can carry that through very readily. And for the benefit of you hearer or tape recorder, the question was, where did Hegel actually get the four-epoch conception of history? Yes. Approach the landing field once more.
He appears to have picked up several of the things that are going to happen in history, according to the source of Christianity. If these points, as he went through each level, he said that it's improbable that they would work, how does it come about? How does either the historical Christianity, either one blank, or does it go step by step, or?
Yeah, okay. Okay. Essentially, the question is it possible to relate the Christian view of history to this so that one can see the precise counterparts along the way? Well, it is in a certain sense, and I've done this a bit in talking about this. It isn't possible to do it in a one-to-one fashion because the Christian view of history is not a monolith. The Christian view of history happens to be the product of the revelation of a personal God. And for this reason, it does not lay the whole pattern of history out in such a way that human beings are able to take what's going on now and predict specifically what's going to happen later. The view of human nature is far more complex in the Christian faith, and the view of God and his relation to the world is far more complex than anything that that Marx was dealing with. And for this reason, we don't have, in the Christian view of history, a kind of computer in which you feed in the data of the present and chuggy chug 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 plunk out drops a statement as to what's coming up. Now, in the ultimate sense, we know what's coming up, but we are not able to say that this is going to occur in a straight, I don't want to use straight line fashion to be confused with this, in a rising curve of this sort. In other words, for the Christian view of history, it may very well be that you have, you know, ups and downs of all kinds. The ultimate movement of this is known, but you can't tell at any given point that you are necessarily exactly 8 miles from the second coming. And it's not realizing that that's gotten some well-meaning but soft-headed Christian believers into all kinds of difficulties. You know, I have a book in my library entitled Is Mussolini the Antichrist? Written by a Canadian evangelist of some repute. And back in the 1930s, this poor fellow saw Mussolini as a kind of potential Roman emperor. You know, and then he read in the book of Revelation about the whore that sitteth on the seven hills, and with a little manipulation, Mussolini came out as the Antichrist. Now, as soon as Mussolini found himself hanging upside down in a very, you know, non-antichristic role, this evangelist bought up the remaining copies of this thing, and when he finally retired, the whole basement of his house was full of them. this is sort of, you know, indicative, eh? In the Bible, Jesus just bends over backwards to say, you don't know the hour of the coming. Huh? The Son of Man comes when you think he's not coming. Huh? And again and again and again, statements are made like this. And it's remarkable that some interpreters of the Bible can manage to miss all of those statements and yet grab on to every single indicator that they think will make it possible to predict the time sequence. As to relating this pyramid, maybe I could make one other point. For the Christian faith, the motivation that corresponds to these first two levels is the action of God, of course. the motivating force in history, in the ultimate sense for the Christian, is neither a materialism nor a kind of built-in automatic dialectic. It is the action of God himself. The thing has a personal grounding. It does not have an impersonal grounding. Ultimately, the universe is understandable in terms of personhood, not in terms of impersonal factors. And as we pointed out, the end result of the whole business is in accord with God's coming to earth in the person of Christ, and the return of Christ in the final judgment. But the intermediate links here are not monolithic, single causal factors like surplus value. In fact, and this is a point that I've made in another one of my writings, the Christian is the one person who is preserved from committing himself either to a materialism or an idealism. You know, this is an ancient argument among historians. What's really important, material things or ideas? Well, this is like if you stopped beating your wife. No matter what you come down on, it isn't appropriate for dealing with certain problems. A person who is limited to a secular interpretation of history feels that he's got to take some factor within this secular frame of reference and make that ultimate, because he's got to have some point of reference. But the Christian has his point of reference in eternity. And his God happens to work through material factors and through idealistic factors through all of the phases of life. Thus, the Christian interpreter is freed from a commitment to single factors, which almost invariably produces that historical sin of reductionism. The Marxist engages in economic reductionism. It may look like an artistic factor, it may smell like an artistic factor, but really, way down deep, it's a materialistic factor. You know? And then there are other people who say, well, it may look like a material factor, it may smell like one, but really it's an idealistic factor if you dig down deeply enough. But this digging down deeply simply creates such a complex and inappropriate interpretation of the given phenomenon that you are left with a very sloshy kind of historical viewpoint. The Christian, in other words, can hang loose in relation to issues like that, because his anchor doesn't happen to be in this stuff down here, ultimately. Okay, one more question, and I think that will be it. Yes?
Would you speak to the class of the reason for studying a book such as Daniel?
Okay, question is, why study a book such as Daniel? You mean an apocalyptic work? A work that purports to offer prediction about the future? Yeah. Well, Sir Robert Anderson in the 19th century wrote a work entitled The Coming Prince. And in this work, he did more careful analysis of the prophecies in the book of Daniel than I have ever seen done by anybody else. And Anderson came to the conclusion that these prophecies are primarily prophecies of the first coming of Christ and not prophecies of the second coming. Now, the second coming works into this to a certain extent, but the main thrust of these prophecies has to do with the first coming. Now, said Anderson, the second coming of Christ in the Bible is clear as to its manner, but not clear as to its time. Jesus said, in the same manner you see me go, I will come, so on. But the time, nobody knows. Said Anderson, I think that the first coming is unclear as to its manner because of the difficulty of relating the suffering servant to Christ's coming in glory, but was clear, at least potentially, as to its time. And Anderson hypothesized that the book of Daniel, this apocalyptic book, which was widely present, widely distributed in the ancient Near East, was the basis for the Magi, for the Persian astrologers, looking for the star at the time they did. You see, why were they looking at that time, for goodness sake? I mean, there's stars all the time, after all. Why were they so carefully regarding the heavens at the particular time they were? Well, they definitely had contact with apocalyptic literature. and this was available in the Parsi setting, in the Zoroastrian setting, and on the basis of the material in Daniel, they could have arrived at the point that this Messiah was coming at a particular juncture, and then they looked for astrological signs of it, or signs in the heavens. Now, the reason that I've brought this up is that we often think that if we can't use a book like Daniel to locate the second coming of Christ next month at 3 p.m., then there's probably something the matter with studying it at all. This is just an indication that there may be other reasons for this kind of material in Scripture. I do think that in the Bible we are told to be aware of the signs of the times. There's no doubt about this. But this never gives us the right to assert that Christ is coming in X period. Eh? It isn't even right for us to say that he must come within our generation or anything like this. This will only mislead the church. There have been periods in history, and I tell you this as a professional historian, there have been periods in history where if I'd been living in them, I would have said, these are the last times. Huh? The fall of Rome, the barbarian invasions, wars, rumors of war, you name it, and they had it. Yet people were not supposed to take the attitude that it must occur at that particular juncture. We are to live, in the words of John Donne, as if this day were the world's last night. You see? Our every moment is to be lived, if you're a Christian, every moment of your life will have to be lived sub specie aeternitatis, from the standpoint of eternity. But this doesn't give you the right to lay down on the job because you are sure that there's no point in establishing a long-term program. all right, and then that is the last question. Yes.
When do you consider the base material that Daniel presented?
Well, I probably better not get into that. I'll give you a reference on that also. For some reason, I seem to be deflecting you by references. But there is an excellent discussion of the book of Daniel in terms of its origins, the conditions involved in the writing of it and so on, in the Old Testament introduction written by Gleason Archer, A-R-C-H-E-R. The title of this is A Survey of Old Testament Introduction, and that came out just within the last few years. Archer is a colleague of mine. He is a PhD from Harvard, and I even if he weren't a colleague of mine, I would consider that book to be the best general introduction to Old Testament critical problems that I know of. It's a superlative work, and it's a good work to pick up so that when you have that same kind of question on the other 38 books of the Old Testament, you'll have a place to go to look for them. All right, that's it for this evening.